what makes the Stoic picture appealing is that you are not trying to align yourself to some external possibility, whether that's an external god or some possibility of technological transformation, but are aiming to perfect what you have right now, you know, what's right in front of you, what's concrete, your ability to manage impressions. Welcome to Stoa Conversations. My name is Caleb Ontiveros.
And I'm Michael Tremblay.
And today we're going to be talking about transhumanism and Stoicism. So it's going to be quite the combo, quite the double feature. I think it's a good one because this issue of transhumanism, which we'll get into, these issues around technology, human nature, and so on, are clearly philosophical. And it raises a question, you know, what can Stoicism add to some of our contemporary debates about the place of technology and, of course, human nature as well? So it's a huge topic, of course, but we're going to dive into it and see what comes out.
And Caleb, this is also something that you're pretty interested in, right? So it's like kind of a something that you know quite a bit about, not just something that we're both learning about, but something you're pretty into, right?
Yeah, I mean, I've certainly read a number of authors who are interested in questions about human enhancement, transhumanism broadly, and it's something I've written about, right, different venues. So it's not something I'm coming to completely fresh by any means. Mm-hmm. What about yourself?
Well, no, I've never thought about this before ever. So so I'm excited to learn, have a conversation with you about it, you know, question some of these ideas, and you know, both of us put it through the lens of Stoicism at the same time.
All right, cool. Well, I thought we should open with a passage from a book called Future Superhuman by Elise Bohan, which I think helps set the stage. Although we don't recognize it, the 21st century is a transhuman era, where everything that currently makes us human, from our brains and bodies to our values and ways of life, is poised to be transformed or superseded. In our lifetime, we could merge with forms of artificial intelligence that are radically smarter than us, rewrite our biology to conquer aging, disease, and involuntary death, leave behind the crudest and cruelest vestiges of our evolutionary programming, and embrace a new mode of being that is so much more than human that we would have to define it as post-human. In its best incarnations, you might call this kind of future superhuman. So I like to open with that passage just because it's excellent framing for what's, I think, a radical challenge to many different philosophical positions, many different common sense beliefs about the world. Kind of gives you a sense of what transhumanism is, which I would define as extending human lifespan, intelligence, and experience through technological innovation so that humans can become superhuman or post-human. And it's really a project of almost technological transcendence that, as Elise Bohan says, aims to make a future superhuman. So, of course, there are a whole range of questions that opens up. You know, is this truly a transhuman era? Is transhumanism possible? You know, is it even possible to do these things that Bohan mentions, merging with artificial intelligence, conquering aging, disease? And if it's possible, you know, would that be good? If any of these things are possible, would that even be a good thing? So we'll consider what we can say from a Stoic perspective on these thoughts, but maybe it's a good idea to pause there and get some initial reactions. What do you think, Michael?
Well, so my two questions for this are, okay, so just so I'm understanding, right, like post-human, it's this idea of a before and after, right? There was humans, and now this is a type difference. This is not a matter of degree. So something like curing cancer is not transhumanism, even though there'd be some sort of technological innovation here. Something like prosthetic limbs, to a limited degree, would not be. But we're talking about some sort of major type difference, you know, something where somebody's living to 300 years old, or somebody who was formerly, you know, superhuman strength with a kind of prosthetic modified body or something like this. I guess what I wanted to clarify that. Is that the extent we're talking about?
Yeah, so I think that all of these things are going to be on a continuum, but I think if you think about extending lifespan, that's on the transhuman scale. It's not at the level of a few years, but many decades, a century, and so on. Mm-hmm. And I think perhaps one way to put it is the transhuman project is pushing the limit as far as one can to the extent that whatever remains may not be human, just as you have past evolutionary processes where different animal species changed and evolved and so on. Even if there were no radical breaks at the moment, there's a sense that the transhuman project is aiming over the span of years, decades, whatever it is, to develop a being that would be properly considered post-human because their lifespan, intelligence, and way of life was so different from the human animal that preceded them.
Yeah, well, that was going to be my follow-up question. Like, I've never thought of humans in terms of types before, you know, like this is post-human, this is, you know, human one, human two, human three. I've never thought of it like that before. So I was thinking, you know, are there different kinds of humans already? Like, I don't know, when we discovered antibiotics, was that a different jump? Was there any jumps in the past? But I guess the point here would be something like, no, because maybe if we can read something like the Stoics and we can empathize with them and go, hey, they're just like us, you know, they're experiencing the same things, they're wrestling with the same questions. There's so many parallels between our lives and Seneca, Marcus Aurelius, Epictetus. That speaks to the fact that transhumanism hasn't occurred before, I would say. It speaks to the fact that because there's that, if you got this kind of post-human, kind of like sci-fi picture, they wouldn't be able to read our philosophy, our existential philosophy, and empathize. I don't know what it's like to feel that kind of, you know, fear of death, or I don't know what it's like to have to wrestle with your limited intelligence. There'd be this kind of empathy break. Does that sound accurate?
I don't think so. I think it's because you could imagine, I think the vision is almost those people would read our philosophy and understand it better than we would. That needn't be the case, but that's, I think, closer to what the movement is aiming for. It's almost there might have a break of some sort, but that's not needed by the philosophy. And I think ideally with jumps in intelligence, even there's a philosopher named Nick Bostrom, and instead of using the word, you know, augmenting experience, he just says augmenting emotion. You can have these beings would have a wider range of possible experiences and a deeper one at that. So maybe they would be better at empathizing than we are. Mm. You know, maybe they would be better at stepping in the sandals of an ancient Egyptian that we are, what have you. So, I mean, it could be the case that that's not true, but I think that at least gets closer to the picture. And I think what you're touching on is there's a lack of clarity, which is necessary, but there's a lack of clarity on, you know, well, what are these beings exactly? Mm-hmm. And I guess like the thought is you can add a little bit more detail by saying, well, perhaps through decades of, you know, genetic modification, introducing things like artificial wombs, you can have human beings that are selected for to such an extent that, you know, they make past geniuses, whether von Neumanns, Einstein, Socrates, and so on, look rudimentary. And of course, they would also happen to be exceptionally healthy physically, and then be, you know, formidable beings able to act in the world, like just as humans can, in that sense. So that, you know, there's that genetics, purely biological path, and then there's a path where humans become cyborgs. Like in some sense, you merge with either other artificial intelligence is forms of biotechnology to the extent that, you know, you can imagine, as is depicted in different science fiction films or books, you end up with a being that is almost half human, to the point where, yeah, okay, you could say that the amount of difference between them and us is significant enough to call them a superhuman.
Yeah, I mean, I'll let you keep going and keep talking a bit about transhumanism, because it sounds like there's these philosophical, once we have a picture, we'll be able to open up this philosophical can of worms about, you know, what it even means to be human, what it means to be more human, less human. So why don't we keep going on, you know, what it means, what transhumanism means, how it could be possible, maybe some objections to it.
Yeah. So as you mentioned earlier, I think we've made some steps already in disrupting human processes or natural processes. So there are physical and cognitive enhancing drugs that change our natural levels of health. We have reproductive technology, existing ways to create new beings or prevent other beings from coming into existence. And of course, we have all of this digital technology that people, some have argued, served almost as an extended mind of some sorts, where someone without the access to Google is in some sense more knowledgeable than someone without that access, if they're able to use it well. And then the thought is that transhumanism would realize these sorts of gains at a whole other scale. It would essentially continue that trajectory such that we end up as different. And as you say, that does bring up a lot of many philosophical questions and many empirical ones too. There's a question of, you know, can human beings really become cyborgs? Is merging with artificial intelligence possible? What about these purely biological routes? Are there going to be steep diminishing marginal returns to selecting for specific traits, and so on? You have those descriptive type questions. And then in addition to that, you have different value judgments. You know, are any of these possibilities, whether they're realistic or not, are they even a good idea? So I think people break this down as different objections to transhumanism. And I think it's useful to go through those and then think through which of these objections would the Stoics reject, which would they accept. So one objection is there's this impossibility idea, just this thought that it can't be done. There are going to be limits on these processes. A related idea is it's too difficult, too costly. That's a cost objection. You can imagine it, that the gains are too uncertain, too far on the horizons for people to care about transhumanism. So those are the sort of empirical objections to the project. And if you think about this, of course, you have this distinction between the way things are, the ways things ought to be. That latter category includes questions of values, what's good, what's bad, and that's where people come in with other objections to transhumanism. It's the idea that it would have negative social effects. In some ways, it would be bad for society. Perhaps it would increase inequality, which someone might think is bad, or result in other downstream consequences that would be negative. You also have this questioning, you know, what's the value of post-humanity as such? You know, would post-human lives be worse than human lives? There's that skepticism about, you know, is it really better to radically increase one's health intelligence and emotional range. And then there's one other objection, which is a little bit, which is related but subtle, which is the thought that whether or not, you know, post-human lives would be good, the value of post-humanity for humans is nil. We couldn't benefit from it. And I think the idea would be we would be so different that there would be no sense in which it would be good for us to become transhuman. So one way to think about this and make it a little bit more concrete is one transhuman scenario that I haven't talked about too much is, you know, scanning the neural patterns in one's brain and uploading it into some computer simulation and so on. And one objection a lot of people have to this scenario is that you are not the kind of thing that can be run in a computer simulation. What you are is, in some sense, embodied in a biological being. So whether or not that simulation has a good life, it wouldn't be you. So it wouldn't be valuable for you to become uploaded in this way. So that's where this other objection comes into play. So then we've got these five objections. It's impossible. It's too costly. The social effects would be terrible. The you know, these post-human lives wouldn't be that good. So this is the value of post-humanity as such. And then whether or not these lives would be good, they wouldn't be good for us. We couldn't benefit. So the value of post-humanity for humans is low. Those are those five objections. What's your initial take on this?
Well, the thing that about transhumanism that's really interesting to me is Stoicism, or at least the way I interpret Stoicism, grounds the value of human lives in teleology, right? Like there's this almost this functionalist account. And so there becomes this question of like, this is a question about actually changing your telos, changing your nature, right? Like Stoicism says you're supposed to live in accordance with your nature. This is a question of actually changing your nature in a foundational way, not achieving that nature, not, you know, becoming more rational, not improving your characteristics to be a better human, but to change into something that's not human, that's post-human. And so that question of, you know, what benefit could post-humanity have for humans? I mean, I can think of some counterexamples, right? Like it might be beneficial for humans to live around kinds of people who are more intelligent and ethical, and maybe, you know, need less resources to survive. Like you can come up with all kinds of counterexamples, but there is this idea at the core about like, how do we treat the technological possibility of changing our nature at a fundamental level? Do we think we would change our nature, or are we getting confused about what our nature really is? But it brings to the head those kinds of questions, which I think are, yeah, they're Stoic questions, but they're also core questions like ancient Greek philosophy more generally.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that's exactly right, which is that this point about the amount of like philosophical questions that transhumanism shines a light on is quite high, and they're important ones, you know, ultimately around these questions of the function of human life, the telos, but also around parts of our lives. You know, we're thinking about some of the earlier examples of the sort of incremental technological improvements around, you know, more digital technology, more ability to increase one's life, more ability to take control of the means of reproduction. You know, all of these are initially quite good, but then they also raise the question, what's the purpose of these tools to begin with, or what's the original purpose that these tools are now used for the sake of? So I think I'm curious on your take about this, but so my sense is that many people object to transhumanism because it wouldn't be good for humanity. And there is this idea that we are in some sense biological beings and we're rooted identified with our biology to the extent that, you know, forsaking the body either by modifying it or transcending it altogether would not be good for us. My sense is that the Stoics wouldn't agree with this objection. And in principle, one, they would not, you know, think that this last objection, this value of post-humanity for humans, is a good one. The reason for that, I think, is that one can survive significant, you know, modification of one's organism for the Stoics. And that's fundamentally because they see human nature not as biological beings, but as embodied rational beings. And that can survive into post-humanity. So the central aspect of human nature for the Stoics was, you know, this part, this reasoning part, this fragment of the divine that allowed one to manage impressions well. And if you think about, you know, these transhuman options, yes, they might be radically different from human beings as we are today, but we still think, you know, they have this ability to reason, perhaps even better than we can. So in that sense, I think that Stoics would not object along this sort of last objection, which is that transhumanism sort of violates human nature or doesn't respect human nature to the extent that it should be respected. What do you think about that?
Yeah, so that's really interesting, Gil. And I mean, this is going to be, we're layering two, we've got the two layers of nerdy, we've got philosophy and the science fiction now on top of each other. So we're going deep here. But I mean, I agree with you, but I want to do a caveat. And I would say it would depend on if technology, so this idea of, you know, you upload your consciousness to the cloud, somebody would say, that's not you, you're flesh and blood. And the Stoics might say, no, you're a reasoning thing. And there you are, reasoning in the cloud, right? And I think it would depend on an understanding of artificial intelligence that I actually lack. I remember my friend runs an AI company, and I was asking him what artificial intelligence was, and he was like, first question is really easy, right? Artificial is anything that's not biological. Second question is really, really complicated. You know, what is intelligence? And so if you could have non-biological intelligence, if you could have non-biological reasoning that was the same kind of reasoning our minds can do, I think the Stoics would be absolutely on board with it. But I think you would have to prove that it's not. So the Stoics have this kind of ontology of being where there's like matter that just like has a form. It's like rocks. Then there's things that generate like plants. There's things that have appetites and impulses like animals. And then humans actually sit at the top of this ontology where we're reason. We have this, our material, you know, our biological matter in our brain for them and in our souls was able to reason. It's able to be self-reflective. And so if technology is capable of doing that in a way that, in a way that's real, and I guess I'm losing the language to say what real is like, but in a way that's real reasoning, then I would agree. But you wouldn't want it to be, well, this is the first type of matter. This is the same type of matter of rocks. This is, you know, electricity and metal that's imitating these reactions in a very complicated, compelling way. But it's not the same kind of heightened, like the heightened material. Like they could actually look at it kind of ontologically, right? Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think that's a great point. One way to put it is, so early we had these different options of becoming post-human, a purely biological one, one that sort of mixes the artificial and the biological, becoming cyborgs. And then you might think of it as a purely artificial one, uploading yourself to the cloud. And I think that the Stoics they at least think we would, what matters persists is retained in the purely biological picture. Depending on how the becoming a cyborg is done, it could be retained. Sure. And then there's more of a question mark around that last one. as you say, which is the kind of mind embodied in non-biological matter, you know, the kind of thing that can be said to reason. And that's, I think, that's a sort of thorny question that one could spend many more episodes on. But I think at least at the initial, what I would be confident in saying that the Stoics are happy with significant biological modification and perhaps also happy with some of these pictures of merging with technology. But it depends on these other artificial options depend on metaphysical assumptions and then some empirical questions about how the minds are in fact embodied.
Yeah, but then there's this other part. I mean, I've just never thought about these questions before. It's really fun taking the, you know, philosophy from 2000 years ago and comparing it to sci-fi. There's this other idea that humans are rational animals, right? We are pro-social. We have certain other things that come with our animal nature that then it's reason's responsibility to enact, right? Like what virtue is a type of reasoning, but the type of reasoning that's virtuous does correspond in some way to our biological nature, right? The fact that we have families, we give birth, we prefer certain, health is preferable. It's not virtuous then to go around hurting people or harming people, right? Because you're, for no good reason, taking away something that's preferable from them. So if we went full transhumanist on this, right, like full kind of science fiction, you might be able to say, well, there's still this picture of virtue looking like reason for this post-human, but then the content of virtue being quite different, right? Or I guess I wouldn't say the content, what it requires of a post-human might end up looking different. That's vague, but it's also, it's a complicated example.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's so you have this idea, well, what are humans essentially for the Stoics? They're rational, but that reason is expressed in a social way, and that's why we insist that the Stoic picture of humans is that we are rational and social creatures. And I do think there has to be this other picture that the social needs to come into the picture for the transhuman. And then, as you say, what that looks like might be different. There's that phrase, what's good for the hive is good for the bee, which Marcus Aurelius cites. And it's a good reminder that we have obligations to the whole. And I think also relevant to this discussion, a Stoic insistence that there is some kind of order, some kind of sociality in whatever transhuman beings emerge, that they play a role in a greater whole. There's that point. And then there's also the point that, of course, for bees, what it is to be social is different than what it is for humans. And that likely will be the same for transhuman creatures, is that it'll be, what that actually looks like might be different depending on their capabilities and proclivities and so on.
Yeah, and stop me if I'm taking this down the wrong direction, but I just think it's super cool because it's almost the same kind of question of like, how would a Stoic judge an alien, right? Like, well, it's a rational creature that has a different nature, or are all rational creatures, do we all have the same nature? The Stoics weren't really able to answer that question because it was just kind of humans for them in their view. But it's like, what would happen if would virtue for an alien be the same as a human? And then the same thing, would virtue for a post-human be the same for a human? I think we're both saying probably pretty very similar in some ways, but a little bit different in others, which is like, again, not exactly a treatise with these exact ways, but it's this interesting question of, is rationality the like superseding highest level, and everything that shares rationality, the virtue is going to look 90% the same, or how much of that other part of what we are gets brought into it, such that, you know, a rational bear from a fairy tale would have a different ethics than a rational human, than a rational alien, and then a computer. And I don't know. Right. I don't know the answer to that. I'm not sure my answer to it, but I think reason. I think things that share reason would be pretty similar. I think, as we're saying, as you said, what it means for the bee is slightly different than what it means for the human, but the things that share reason would have a fundamental role in common that is so broad it would encompass a lot of the same kind of character requirements, I think.
Yeah, I think, well, we've talked about role ethics before, and there's these different levels to role ethics. You have that universal picture of our roles, you know, to be rational and social beings, and then you narrow down depending on our talents, capabilities, depending on our social situations, what kind of relationships we have, and then our preferences. So I suppose you could say with these other beings at the top, they will have the same fundamental roles. And as such, we should expect some of the central virtues to be expressed, at least in the fundamental abstract way, in a similar manner. But once you get to those lower levels of course, capabilities are going to be radically different. The social world may be exceptionally different. And then, of course, one can only speculate about the preferences of these beings. So at those later levels, these more specific questions, you might see a level of difference.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's just a fun question. We're so kind of, as humans, we're reflective, but we're like the only reflective things. I mean, we're kind of stuck in this conundrum by ourselves. It would be so interesting. I mean, that's why I think why people are so interested in aliens, right? So interested to see what rationality would look like manifested in a different being, or reason would look like manifested in something else.
Right, right. Yep. So that's one central issue that emerges, this question of, you know, can we, in a real sense, persist as post-humans? I think the Stoics would say yes, with those caveats we mentioned earlier. And then, nonetheless, what that would, of course, amount to would be radically, radically different. So that's one, I think, important issue. Another important issue, I think, at least perhaps warning that emerges from Stoic philosophy, or something that's distinct in Stoic philosophy from any other modern points of view, is just that more isn't necessarily best overall. What do I mean? So if you think about, one obvious argument for transhumanism is that what transhumanism does is it extends our health, you know, it improves our health, makes us smarter, and gives us a wider range of good experiences. And since all of those things are good, the thought would be, why don't we just do that to the maximal extent possible? But of course, the Stoics think things like lifespan, intelligence, physical capabilities, pleasure, and so on, are not ultimately good. Instead, they are indifference. You know, the things that each of them are preferable. But what ultimately matters is being virtuous and making the right choices amongst these preferable type things, which means that more is not always necessarily the best, which I think is a challenge to a central, so I think one of the central intuitions behind transhumanism, and puts a constraint on our pursuit of augmenting our capabilities, not just in this sort of lofty pursuit of becoming transhuman, but also in ordinary activities of increasing our health, increasing our pleasure, and so on.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like about this, like, I think it's a good point, but it raises this interesting question about, well, what do you feel about something like like testosterone replacement therapy or cosmetic surgery for somebody who's born with a, some sort of facial problem. I generally feel like the Stoics would say, look, like, change it if you can and if you want to, but you don't need to have a good life, and people that don't like can still have good lives. So I kind of see it as like, again, it's preferable, right? It's do it if you can. Don't compromise your virtue for it. Don't, you know, steal money and harm somebody to get the money to do this, and don't, but if it's available to you, take it. So to me, extending that to transhumanism, maybe not that, you know, the brain in the cloud is a bit abstract, but let me think of these cyborg modifications or life extend, you pay money and you can extend your life by 50 years, or you can freeze yourself and get reanimated or something like this. I think I would generally think the Stoic argument would be like, yeah, like, you know, go ahead if it's for the right reasons and it hasn't compromised your virtue in pursuit of it. But you think it's a step further? You think the Stoics would be against these kinds of things? Or is it just kind of like a, you know, let's not divert our resources to this when there's more important things we could be doing, something like that?
Yeah, I would say it's more of a warning. So yeah, we might be in agreement, but if I think about the cosmic surgery case, in some ways what the Stoic view is almost unsatisfying. It's almost, it always depends or something like this, because I don't see a strong prohibition against cosmetic surgery.
That's a different kind of, that's the view.
Yeah, it's a different kind of surgery. So too advanced for me. I don't see a strong prohibition for cosmetic surgery coming from the Stoics, but they would question, you know, who are you? Why are you doing this operation? And I think people could have good answers to that, and they could have bad answers to it. And I think there's also these issues of, well, what are the best social norms? You know, what are the roles where you happen to live, when you happen to live, that best serve society? Are you playing into the right ones for your time? So I would say that, you know, I think this provides some constraints on becoming transhuman. It's sort of like, well, we should think it's a good thing to promote our lifespan, our intelligence, and so on. But we always need to have that reflective stance toward it, both as individuals and as a society at large, and be willing to entertain arguments against doing these sorts of things. So perhaps it's more of a higher level heuristic to pause, not always go jump straight ahead into augmenting ourselves. But I don't think that the Stoics would have this a prohibition just because these things are indifferent.
Well, yeah, well, it's, as you put it, right? It's more isn't necessarily better. That doesn't mean more is bad. It just means exactly what you said. More isn't necessarily better, and so that's a warning. That's a reason to interrogate your reasons for being attracted to transhumanism or attracted to these kinds of pursuits of changing yourself, right? And mm-hmm. ask yourself, as you said, who you are and why you're doing it.
Yeah. The Stoics are, of course, fans of moderation, and I think to some extent they have a radical view here, which is that, you know, if we become transhuman, what's important about human nature can persist. To that extent, Stoicism is radical, but it's still going to have this focus on nothing in excess, taking all things into account when making decisions as a society and as an individual to the extent that one can. And that, I think, means probably more of a focus on some of these incremental changes, an acknowledgement of uncertainty. You know, we opened up with that quote about we live in a transhuman era. I think there's still some question marks around that, but on the margin, perhaps more people should move in that direction given the possibility of radical change in artificial intelligence and bio technology in particular.
And I guess there's also this idea of kind of a lack of satisfaction too, right? Like a lack of an ability to be happy with what is, happy with the way things are, and then a kind of vicious pursuit to get out of that as well, that transhumanism can kind of appeal to. One thing that I was thinking, Kev, I'm interested in what you think about this, like, sometimes I think about this idea, I don't know if this is Jungian or whatever, but there's like patterns in thought, and that these patterns in thought manifest in different ways. And so one pattern in thought is this idea that I want to transcend. And so maybe that meant like you, that was manifested through this idea of heaven, but then it was also manifested in transhumanism. But then in Stoicism, this idea of transcendence finds itself in the idea of the sage, right? Like Stoicism sells a picture of something that's kind of post-human, and it idealizes that picture of the post-human, the human that, like, you know, doesn't seem possible. If they are possible, they come around once every 500 years. So it's a kind of a superficial possibility. So what do you think that says about this idea of like more isn't always better, or moderation? When I feel like the Stoics, I guess, didn't practice that. Well, they were immoderate, but in terms of just the good thing, you know, the sage, pursue that intensely. That is better. Transform to post-human in that way. So the idea is it's just like be moderate about these indifference, but there's still that appeal in Stoicism of kind of changing your nature fundamentally.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think Stoicism has it does have an ambition towards truly transforming yourself. And there's almost a tension between that possibility being imminent, being available to you right now, with also this recognition that the sage is a distant possibility. I would almost contrast it with pictures of heaven or standard monotheistic pictures, where the picture of many monotheistic religions is to become the kind of person who is worthy of God. Whereas a picture of many Greek philosophies, Roman philosophies, was to become a god in a real sense. Like you have this fragment of the divine within you, perfect it, and then you will become like a god yourself. Which both, I think both includes that picture of transcendence, radical transformation, but also has a more tangible, imminent possibility, or at least promise that is offered than some of the traditional monotheistic religions.
Oh no, and that just strikes me as being transhumanist in goal. Just not lifespan, not physical strength or health, but transhumanist morally. Like you become a kind of post-human morally, the kind of person who can't make mistakes.
Yeah. I would almost want to say post-human. Another way the Stoics might say, you're becoming fully human, right? Or living out your full human nature. But I think, I understand. I think in a way that also leaves up, not exactly an objection to transhumanism, but this thought that what makes the Stoic picture appealing is that you are not trying to align yourself to some external possibility, whether that's an external god or some possibility of technological transformation, but are aiming to perfect what you have right now, you know, what's right in front of you, what's concrete, your ability to manage impressions. So I think they have that picture of radical self-improvement, transformation with a transhumanist, I think we'd be happy to, you know, push the arc of human development forward, always with the eye to one's life. Of course, doesn't depend on, you know, living an excellent life doesn't depend on these transhuman capabilities, except, as you say, in the moral or ethical domain.
Yeah, I really like what you said there, where you said, you know, you're not trying to align yourself with something external. So in Stoicism, you're not trying to align, you know, like, oh, this is what God wants, and I'm going to try to be like the kind of thing God wants. Or, you know, technology is really cool. I'm not technology. I'm going to become more like a cyborg. There's just this thing of just being yourself as much as possible. And so even in Stoicism, there's the idea of living in accordance with nature, but the higher level truth is obviously just that you're already part of nature. And so your goal to live in accordance with nature is not to do anything, but like walk alongside the cart of fate, to use that metaphor. I'm not adding anything new here. I'm just kind of ruminating on that idea of it's, and in that way, it's like, that's cool. There's like a lot less, I guess, kind of friction there, right? It's just like, just be yourself more. And obviously that's bringing in a certain picture of what you are. And if you don't agree with the Stoics there, that's the friction. I'm not this rational being. I'm not only a rational being, or I'm not primarily, my rationality doesn't look the way the Stoics think it looks. There can be some friction there, but this permission to just, as you said, not become post-human in the Stoic view, but become as human as possible, become fully human. I'm feeling pumped up. I'm feeling inspired. that's a huge part of the appeal. You're dead on.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll be talking about the Stoic God next. That's on our schedule. And I think what you just said made me think of, of course you're not aligning yourself to anything external, but in a sense you already have the external in you, which is, I mean, on the surface might seem like a mystical thought, but it's just this picture that, you know, you do have that fragment of the divine reason. Reason is, you are a rational creature, but that ability to reason is somehow reflective or maps onto, is embodied in the larger whole, the external. And perhaps we'll get into that more in our next conversation.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Awesome. Well, that's transhumanism. I had a number of other notes, but I think that's gets us in a good spot. And the most important things I wanted to put on the table, just this possibility of transhumanism, I think it's worth thinking about. Radical technological change. Elise Bohan's book is a good one on this. And then thinking through, you know, what are some of these philosophical questions, objections that arise with the possibility of transhumanism, and how would the Stoics think about it? So I think we've got some of the most important thoughts, argumentative moves on the table. Awesome. Thanks, Michael.
So the picture here is something like, the Stoics don't object to transhumanism in principle. There could be a version where there's some version of post-humanism that looks like, look, if you become a cyborg, if you become a supercomputer AI, that might not necessarily actually interfere with your nature fully. There's at least a possibility of, you know, cyborgs that still can be Stoics, right? Because they still have this piece of the divine in them that's the most important part of them. So they don't have an in-principle objection to transhumanism, but there are warnings about both why we might want it and why it might appeal to us. And then, I mean, I think most importantly, those and thinking about this idea that, you know, more isn't necessarily better, and that there's some acceptance of the way things are. You don't want transhumanism to become this way of just trying to escape reality or escape nature. And then what we ended on was that really interesting distinction between how, I don't think transhumanism necessarily does this, but if transhumanism is about this attempt to align yourself with something outside of yourself, then that's not Stoic, because Stoic is about becoming as human as possible. And I know that I think was a really good way of putting Stoicism at its core.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Well summarized.
Cool.
Awesome. Well,
thanks, Gil.
Yeah. Thanks, Michael. Thanks for listening to Stoic Conversations. Please give us a rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and share it with a friend. If you want to dive deeper still, search Stoa in the App Store or Play Store for a complete app with routines, meditations, and lessons designed to help people become more stoic. And I'd also like to thank Michael Levy for graciously letting us use his music. You can find more of his work at ancientliar.com. And finally, please get in touch with us. Send a message to stoa@stoameditation.com if you ever have any feedback, questions, or recommendations. Until next time.